From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
If there's one thing that has unified Democrats and Republicans, and everybody in between, it's that we all hated the bank bailout.
What is popular with the populace? In his State of the Union address Wednesday, President Barack Obama had just the ticket, bashing bankers and lobbyists and insurance companies and even TV talking heads. It was hardly a tirade, and it came too late to preserve the Democrats' supermajority in the Senate, but perhaps not too late to rally Americans to his ambitious program. Because "we must" hasn't worked too well for the president, so perhaps "because they don't want us to" will strike a nerve. Obama thus, however timidly, joined a club of us versus themers, going back to William Jennings Bryan, Father Coughlin, Joe McCarthy, and Huey Long, not to mention Richard Nixon, Spiro Agnew, George Wallace, Sarah Palin, Lou Dobbs, and Glenn Beck. But if populism is a favorite tactic of the right, the left also has a long history of demonizing a disproportionately powerful other, tycoons being right at the top of the list. Michael Kazin, a history professor at Georgetown University and author of The Populist Persuasion in American History, says put-upon electorates tend to distill complex problems into a sense of undue influence held by an arrogant few.
I think it's basically a language of discontented people who blame elites for the problems, whether economic problems, political problems, cultural problems. It's the people against the elite.
Haven't all presidential candidates in some way been populist in their message, claiming to represent the largest number of American voters?
Well, they all try to represent the largest number, but they don't all rail against an elite. Adlai Stevenson, for example, was very clear that he wanted to speak to the intelligent people, as he called them, and he was very loath to use populist rhetoric. And that was also true for the most part of Dwight Eisenhower, who defeated him in the 50s. And really, it's from the 60s on that most successful presidential candidates have used this rhetoric, because we've had a lot of social turmoil since the 60s, a turmoil that it's often useful for politicians to depict one particular elite, economic for liberals, cultural for conservatives, who they blame for most of the problems.
Well, you just raised an interesting point that David Brooks addressed in his New York Times column this week. Which elite is destroying our society depends on who you are. The Republicans traditionally look at the classic Adlai Stevenson figure, the academic, the Ivy League educated, tweedy progressive, as the intellectual elite that is out of touch with mainstream America. And Democrats, as the President of the United States did in this week's State of the Union, seized on bankers who, from their gilded boardrooms, manipulate the world financial system for their own greedy, nefarious purposes. Are these two caricatures equally elites?
Yes, of course. As you say, it depends who's attacking and who's being attacked. The original populists began very much on the left. They opposed Wall Street. They opposed big banks. They wanted nationalization of the railroads, and they wanted nationalization of a lot of things. They also had cultural resentments. The original populists were rural people, for the most part, and they didn't like the big cities and were very suspicious of intellectuals, who at the time were mostly conservative. Since 1945, conservative populists tend to rail against Hollywood, Cambridge, bureaucrats in Washington. Liberal populists rail against Wall Street, big corporations, and big banks. That's usually the way the roster of enemies works.
Okay, so the term populism goes back 120-some years, but more recently it became popular. How?
Well, there was a huge debate among American historians in the 1950s and 1960s about the nature of populism, and a lot of liberal historians and social scientists argued that McCarthyism was a form of populism. They argued populism was not this rational, liberal, or left-wing critique of free market capitalism, but in fact it was a system of irrational hatreds, of blaming alien non-American forces for the problems of the country. A lot of journalists went to school and read about this very influential interpretation of populism. And then when they began to report on people like George Wallace in the late 1960s, and to some degree on people like George McGovern in the early 1970s, they said, well, both these guys are angry. They seem to be channeling a lot of this discontent in somewhat demagogic ways. So populism is an inclusive term, a way to talk about this anti-establishment anger. And since that point, the use of the term populism really skyrockets from the early 1970s onward. And we've never lost it since then.
Okay, so I've heard you say that you don't necessarily want populism to be deemed a pejorative. And yet, when you go down the list, you know, with the possible exception of George McGovern, whose enemy was the military-industrial complex, it's all people who are scapegoating someone or other for what ails the society. Isn't that demagogic in and of itself?
Well, are they scapegoating those people or are they blaming those people? It's not the same thing. We believe this country is supposed to run for the interests of the large majority of the people who are hardworking and God-fearing and patriotic. As long as we have that belief, then people will look for people to blame and look for people to represent their discontent. And people listen to NPR might prefer they do that in very quiet, academic, look at all sides ways, but that's not how politics works.
Well, Michael, thank you very, very much.
You're very welcome, Bob. Enjoyed doing it.
Michael Kazin is a professor of history at Georgetown University and author of The Populist Persuasion and American History. If members of the media weren't parsing populism this week, they were wondering about the plight of what German novelist Hermann Hesse once called the fat and prosperous brood of mediocrity, a.k.a. the middle class.
The price of college tuition is just one of the burdens facing the middle class. That's why last year I asked Vice President Biden to chair a task force on middle-class families.
And if you believe the conventional wisdom of both President Obama and the punditry, the middle class is fat and prosperous no more. They are under attack, in decline, and threatened with total extinction. Of course, it's a time-tested tactic of populism to pander to the big brood. But who exactly are the middle class, and what evidence is there of its impending doom? Stephen Rose is an economist and author of the upcoming book, Rebound, Why America Will Emerge Stronger from the Financial Crisis. And he joins me now. Stephen, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
First of all, putting Hermann Hesse aside, where did the term middle class come from?
Well, the first origins basically arise when people moved to cities. And the middle class became all those in the cities who were neither owners nor workers. They were the artisans, the professionals, people who were on their own and did a little better than workers, but who weren't owners and certainly weren't landowners. And then as the cities developed in the 20th century, once you started talking about a chicken in every pot and home ownership, middle class became more a term of middle standard of living, and workers then could aspire to it. And by the 1950s, as the economy then grew from World War II and the Depression, it became more and more popular.
Well, in the developing world, let's just say India, the middle class, while large and growing, is still a relatively small slice of the overall population. In the United States, you know, unless I'm missing something, it's almost all of us, right?
If you ask people to self-describe themselves and you ask, are you upper class, upper middle, or lower class, then virtually everyone will pick some form of middle class. In a 2008 survey from the Pew Research Center, 57% just called themselves middle class, but another 38% tacked on the term upper or lower middle class, pretty divided evenly. That left only 2% of the people saying they were in the upper class, and 6% saying they were in the lower class.
You have identified what you call myths about the middle class that you say are perpetuated by the press and by politicians when it suits their purposes.
Well, there are a number of researchers that's tried to show that the economy is worse off because they think that's the way that you convince people to support liberal politics. I want to be clear that I was a Clinton appointee and I'm on their side. I just think that it's more important to get the truth. most people talk about 1980 to the present. So that's about 30 years. And a number of people will say the middle class has gone nowhere in that 30 years. They'll say that all the income growth went to the top 10%. They'll say that their standards of living haven't improved. And if they've improved, it's only because they're working longer. So they're working longer for basically the same thing. And another variation is that all the jobs are being created are low-end jobs, the McJobs. We're now a service economy, therefore all service economy must be dead-end and low pay. And then there, what I would argue is almost purposeful misstatements on the state of income distribution over time.
So are you saying that it's not true that our standard of living within the middle class has gone down, not up, over the past 25 years?
I'm certainly saying that, and I think there's a lot of data that would show that. It is indeed true that the wealthiest quarter have indeed gotten much more than other sectors of the economy, but it is not true that the middle class has gotten zero. Real income per capita from 1980 to today is up like 65%. That's an average, of course. And if all gains were shared equally over the last 30 years, their standard of living would have been up 48% across the board. In my data, I show it's up 32%. 32% is a far way from zero. Part of that is that women are indeed working longer. There's no question. But even if you simulated if women worked the same amount of hours that they did in 1980, you'd still find household couples having higher incomes.
So what you're saying is that to properly report on this subject, you have to be able to hold two ideas in your head at the same time. One, that wealth has not necessarily been evenly distributed. And two, that nonetheless, the middle class has done pretty well.
Correct. One of the things about how the media covers the middle class is that they are somewhat taken in by it, the story that everything is gloom and doom. Partially, it's that good news is boring, and therefore, when you try and find out something different, especially before the current crisis, you have someone like Robert Kuttner writing that from 1980 to 2005, we should look at this period as one of the silent depression. A silent depression during the Reagan boom years and the Clinton super boom years. This is really a remarkable statement to make. And the issue is we should care about people who are not doing well. But they're making it appear as if it's way over the majority that are being hurt. And what I would argue is the glass is more than half filled.
All right. Stephen, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a lot of fun.
Stephen Rose is an economist and author of Rebound, Why America Will Emerge Stronger from the Financial Crisis, due out in April from St. Martin's Press. This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Before even the first aftershock of the Haiti earthquake, journalist Steve Kahl explained how disaster coverage follows a prescribed path. For instance, on day 5, you'll have your late miracle story, someone pulled alive from the rubble, for example. On the first Sunday following the tragedy, there'll be the interpretation of meaning stories and lots of interviews with religious leaders. And day 12, he calls heading for the exits. According to Kahl, that's when editors begin to call their reporters home. So far, Steve Kahl seems to be right, most recently about that last one. 2 weeks after the earthquake, TV networks and print outlets are dramatically scaling back their Haiti presence. But one journalist who isn't going anywhere is the Associated Press's Jonathan Katz. Before the earthquake, he was the only American reporter based permanently in Haiti. We spoke to him on a bad phone line from Port-au-Prince, and he told us that before January 12th, he was pretty much on his own down there.
It's true that I don't usually get a lot of company on the island until something major happens. As it happens, something major seems to happen in Haiti every couple of years, and it then gets that kind of attention, but it's certainly not constant. I very much have to be to myself a lot of the time.
In the absence of infrastructure and ordinary resources like cell phone coverage and internet and so forth, has your knowledge and your connections on the island conferred any sort of advantage to you, or are you just as lost as anybody else?
Well, fortunately and unfortunately, this tragedy is not the first time that we've had experience here with down cell phone lines or ineffective communication networks or, you know, emails that get lost in the ether. It's something that we're used to. But there's a lot of things that go into reporting about a country like this that don't necessarily come down to being able to get a hold of somebody right at the particular moment that you need to get a hold of that one person. It has a lot to do with understanding the history, understanding the culture. And when you're talking to somebody on the street, which is really where I try to focus my coverage, talking to Haitians and finding out how they're experiencing what's going on at any particular moment, that context comes into play, and it enables me, I think, I hope, to provide a certain amount of understanding and background in the story that maybe somebody who had just parachuted in wouldn't be able to provide. But frankly, in those first days, I didn't know if I needed to get a hold of a source, if they were even alive or dead.
Have you had to bury some substantial percentage of your Rolodex?
I've lost friends in this earthquake. Not just contacts, but people who were friends of mine, people who were important. Beyond that, there are a number of officials or people who I had contact with at various points, people who I would ordinarily turn to in a situation like this, who I would be in touch with right now, asking their opinions, asking for information, who are gone. And that's something that I don't think anybody's prepared for.
What's your reaction to the fact that the world's interests are going to move on now to the next big story, the next catastrophe?
As a journalist, it's certainly something that I understand. Audiences hold their attention on a certain story for a certain amount of time, and then after that, they move on to other things. People for whom Haiti is not part of their daily reality in their daily lives, they only maybe have so much emotional effort to expend on a single tragedy like this. But as somebody who's seeing the incredible levels of suffering that are going on in this country right now, I hope that the waning of attention is temporary and measured and is not the full extent that we've seen in the past, where it basically just falls down to zero until the next tragedy happens, because this tragedy is not over and will not be for a very, very long time.
One final thing, Jonathan. When CNN and ABC and NBC and a bunch of newspapers pull up stakes and fly back to the mainland, They are going to be ceding to you once again the Haiti story. You know, has it occurred to you that, you know, you may be the sole American journalistic witness to the reconstruction of a society from dust?
It's possible. I mean, it's occurred to me. I don't know how quickly that's going to happen, really. I mean, we're seeing it scaling down, but it's not scaling down to zero or one, as the case may have been. I don't think that we're going to see over the course of this year, and this is speculation, but I don't think we're going to see over the course of this year a situation where I'm the only one here. A lot of journalists have come here for the first time, and they've discovered this place, and they left talking about wanting to come back and do stories over the coming months and probably the coming years. So I don't think that it's going to go back quite to the level where it was before. But yeah, I mean, I think to a certain extent, the responsibility is going to fall back on us once again to be at least a very, very significant part of the coverage here. And it's a responsibility that I take very seriously. And it certainly provides a lot of opportunities to do stories that other people aren't going to do. And hopefully, if people really do pull out, they'll continue reading our stuff.
All right, Jonathan, I thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jonathan Katz is the Haiti correspondent for the Associated Press. Staying on a news story after a disaster has always been a challenge for news organizations. The news, by definition, must be new. Increasing stability is not that big of a story. That's one reason in recent months Iraq has receded from the headlines, but this week it came exploding back after three suicide bombers struck Baghdad hotels favored by Westerners, including Western media. 37 people died and more than 100 were injured in blasts at the Sheraton, Babylon, and Hamra hotels. We spoke to the Washington Post's Baghdad bureau chief Ernesto Londano, whose staff had an extremely close call on Monday. Many were in the Hamra hotel when the car bomb exploded. Londano himself was just leaving an interview when he heard the first explosion.
I was actually interviewing the government spokesman about these controversial handheld devices that the Iraqis use to try to detect explosives. They've come under scrutiny because many people, including the U.S. military, thinks they don't work. And as I was leaving that interview, we heard a pretty powerful explosion. I was with a colleague, and we scurried inside the building again, and within a couple of minutes heard a second very powerful blast, and then a third. Within minutes, we were alerted that one of those had struck at our compound. My colleague and I returned to the bureau and found that our house was essentially completely destroyed. All the windows were blown out, furniture had been strewn around, and a handful of my Iraqi colleagues had been wounded. Fortunately, their injuries were not life-threatening, but our ability to remain in that compound is now in question.
We read a piece by the McClatchy foreign editor talking about the experience his bureau had. They'd pulled out of their digs in the Hamra Hotel because they perceived the security situation there to be deteriorating, particularly the removal of bomb blast barriers for reasons that were unclear. I guess they just suspected that something was up. Did you guys suspect that something was up?
In fact, a number of us got together maybe 3-4 months ago and discussed how we could beef up perimeter security, and we were actually in the process of doing so. We brought on board 10 additional guards to stand outside those checkpoints because in the wake of the bombings we saw last fall, we realized that these buildings were landmarks, that they were targets, and that we were pretty much low-hanging fruit. So this was actually a fairly active debate. And my colleagues and I spent a great amount of our time over the last few months trying to mitigate that threat.
Over here, we've had the general sense that security issues were beginning to ease over there. Can you tell us the lay of the land at the moment?
This has never been an easy story to cover. One of the major difficulties is how quickly the threats evolve. The threats have changed here pretty much on a monthly basis. And the evolution has been particularly difficult to adapt to under the financial constraints that many news organizations are under these days. At the beginning of the war, there was a sense among the journalists that money was a secondary concern. And with so many news organizations struggling financially, as we weigh the pros and cons of operating here, as we weigh what kind of risks are worth taking in the pursuit of journalism, it has become a lot trickier because our budgets are a lot smaller.
Give us an example of how the financial situation at the Post, for example, has a bearing on how you report.
It essentially boils down to how many people we can have on staff and how many resources we devote to security. At the Post, managers have always been extraordinarily supportive and have always prioritized security. But there's a sense among all of us that it is no longer as easy to convince our bosses, convince the newspaper publishers that you can keep very large bureaus here. You certainly have still a handful of newspapers and wire agencies and a dwindling number of broadcast journalists that are still committed to the story and that still devote a significant amount of money to covering it. But I think as you look at the year ahead, after we cross the benchmark of the election in March, I wouldn't be surprised if many news organizations shrink their footprint here dramatically.
So what about traveling out of Baghdad? Has it become safer for you to venture into the provinces than it had been a couple of years ago?
Toward the end of 2007, early 2008, the roads became a lot safer, the security forces became more effective, and more of the country was within reach. You know, we had the ability of going, for example, to Fallujah or Ramadi on a day trip to do reporting. We had the ability to drive down to Basra. We had the ability to drive up to the Kurdish area in northern Iraq. I think in the wake of what happened on Monday, I think all of us are taking a step back and trying to assess what the threat level is and what sorts of threats we need to worry about, we need to be concerned about.
Who decides when the pullout of U.S. troops has reached a sufficient stage for Iraq not to be a story anymore? Will you stick around to figure out whether Baghdad will become Saigon, whether the government will function, the security situation will stay relatively stable, or will you be gone before this story plays out?
I don't know. I think that's a question that many of us ask ourselves here and that many of us have raised with our editors. I think there will be a Western press corps here through the pullout of American troops. But I think those of us here on the ground will lobby for and try to argue that a sustained presence here is the responsible thing to do, is the right thing to do, and it's necessary.
All right, Ernesto. Many thanks for spending the time with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Ernesto Londano is the Baghdad bureau chief for The Washington Post. While the American news organizations still in Iraq struggle to cover the war, the American military continues its struggle to fight it. The U.S. Army has long used video games like tank simulators and first-person shooters to train troops in conventional on-the-ground warfare, but the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are anything but conventional. U.S. troops are fighting insurgencies, and in order to learn the different set of skills that calls for, officers have been using a simulator that resembles the computer game SimCity. Just like its commercial counterpart, Urban Sim has users build roads, buildings, and utility grids. But unlike SimCity, there are suicide bombs to avoid, jihadist insurgents to fend off, and local citizens to protect and win over. Kim LeMasters is the creative director of the Institute for Creative Technologies at the University of Southern California, which developed Urban Sim. He says some members of the military refer to the project as a game, but
I use the word game lightly because there's no shoot 'em ups, there's nothing going on in this other than really a design that helps people understand what second and third order effects are all about.
Define, please, second and third order effects.
Second and third order effects are the consequences, either seen or unforeseen, of an action that you take. So, for example, I decide to put in a hydroelectric dam at Village X. What I didn't foresee was that Village Y was very, very upset and jealous that I built one for Village X, and Village Y, therefore, became a safe harbor for insurgents. Here I think I'm doing something very, very good, and it can have a very negative effect. That's really what it's all about. What are those seen and unforeseen consequences of any action that you take?
Tell me what it looks like. What's the interface?
You're looking at basically a bird's eye view down onto an environment called an area of operation. You have an enormous amount of user feedback that's coming back. The military uses something they call lines of effort to describe how they are making progress and stability. And lines of effort can be about governance. It can, in fact, be about infrastructure. It can be about how the population feels about you. So that as somebody is playing the game, they're literally watching in real time how these lines of effort are being completed.
I guess ultimately this is about pacifying towns and cities, not merely by shooting the enemy, but also by stabilizing the environment. In the modern army in Iraq, how much of the counterinsurgency involves bullets and explosives? How much involves education and police?
The central tenet of counterinsurgency strategy is that the population is the center of gravity. So your entire job while you are in the host nation is, in fact, to get that population to be on your side, to understand that you are providing security, that you're providing infrastructure, that what you're doing is good. If you get them on your side, that's the win.
I wonder how resistant the modern soldier is to the whole idea of counterinsurgency techniques that do involve working with the populations as opposed to just killing the bad guy. Is the modern army officer accepting of these simulations and the strategy that the simulations are training for?
Very much so. It becomes quite apparent that the hammer does not always work, that, you know, you've got to drink tea as well. Their job first is force protection. I mean, am I taking care of my soldiers? And the only way to do that is if I'm prosecuting stability as much as I am prosecuting offense or defense.
Is there any risk in preparing officers the way Urban Sim does that they will become sort of, overconfident in believing that they've got all of the variables well understood, leaving them more vulnerable to a situation they reach on the ground that they fail to understand because it wasn't in the game?
The game goes to an extreme to make sure that the players understand that they are not learning, you know, here's the way it must be done every single time. Rather, they are being challenged to understand completely that when they take an action, have they done to the best of their ability an anticipatory take on what's going to happen? So do I understand I'm going to have second and third order effects? I might even have fourth order effects of what's going on. I don't always know what they're going to be, but how well can I begin to plan for what they might be? And then finally be prepared for that one order of effect that occurs that you never thought of. So we bend over backwards to make sure that we're not trying to train them in, congratulations, you've played Urban Sim 5 times, go off to Afghanistan, be successful. Uh-uh, not what we're doing.
Obviously, this is grossly oversimplistic, but it sounds to me that above all, what you take from your experience with Urban Sim is something like understanding that the reality on the ground is something like a spreadsheet, and every field you fill in affects every other field.
You've got it. That's exactly right.
So tell me again why we're losing these wars.
Well, see, the way we'd win it is if we can get all of these countries that we're involved with, if we can get them to play Urban Sim, then we're set. No, I think the ground truth is always different than what you want it to be. And that's just the case of it. And the other thing, too, is remember that the bad guys are very crafty, and they are bound and determined to try to create second and third order effects that you didn't think of. That's what they want to do. They want disruption. They want to control the space on you. So it's a very tough environment that these soldiers find themselves in.
Well, Kim, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to be on the show.
Kim LeMasters is Creative Director of the Institute for Creative Technologies at the University of Southern California. Coming up to Apple's fancy new gadget, the much-anticipated iPad, a resounding... This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. The John Deere and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. In a stunning reversal earlier this month, Google wrote on its official blog that it would stop censoring its search results in China, as mandated by the communist government, or else quit operating in the country altogether. The announcement came shortly after some of the company's email accounts were hacked into, an attack Google said it traced to China. In response, a Chinese foreign ministry spokeswoman said, quote, China welcomes international internet enterprises to conduct business in China according to law. Just as Google and China were facing off in a game of international chicken, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton gave a strongly worded speech in Washington on the subject of internet freedom.
The internet has already been a source of tremendous progress in China, and it is fabulous. But countries that restrict free access to information or violate the basic rights of internet users risk walling themselves off from the progress of the next century.
Suddenly, it seems, after years of teeth-clenched tolerance, corporate and political entities here in the U.S. are intent on confronting China over suppression of speech on the internet. Jeremy Goldcorn is founder and editor of Donwei.org, a website that monitors the Chinese media. He watched Clinton's speech in his adopted home of Beijing, and he joins me now. Hey, Jeremy, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Bob.
You didn't just watch Secretary Clinton's speech in Beijing. You watched it at the U.S. Embassy. How did that come to pass?
Well, I somehow got myself on a list of bloggers that the U.S. Embassy has been inviting to various functions as part of the Obama administration's Web 2.0 communication effort. The first one was just before the Obama visit to China last year, and they invited a crowd of Chinese bloggers to the embassy to watch a recording of Hillary Clinton's speech, and I was in that group.
You know, from our vantage here in the States, Clinton's speech sounded very tough and got a lot of praise from those who have thought all along that the U.S. should be taking a harder line against China's systematic suppression of free speech. I'm just going to take a wild guess and suppose that the Chinese government had a slightly different view of things.
Well, immediately after the Google reaction, there was a very muted reaction from the Chinese government for about a week. They didn't really say too much except that they were seeking clarity on Google's intentions. Quite mild statements. After Hillary Clinton's speech, a barrage of state-written propaganda was unleashed, commentaries and editorials and articles all condemning the speech and what they called American information imperialism.
It's hard for me to understand how that could be, though, if both Google and the U.S. government are calling for the Chinese to have the information of their choosing, not what is chosen by the Chinese government.
Well, yes, Bob, but you are part of the American imperialist media machine, so of course you don't understand. The Chinese government argument is that China does not produce as much information as America. Therefore, if the internet is completely open, the huge volumes of information, pro-American information coming out of the United States will deluge China and somehow put Chinese-produced information in an inferior position. That is the rather torturous logic that has been used in many of the editorials that have been running in newspapers.
There has been endless debate on this program and elsewhere about the government's ability in the long run to maintain the great firewall that enables it to monitor and censor internet content and generally suppress speech, especially political speech, in an internet age. I'm just curious whether you think if the great firewall came tumbling down tomorrow, would the government lose its legitimacy immediately?
Well, I don't think they would, but there is a very strong strain of a sort of Leninist type of ideology of control that seems to be in the very bones of the Communist Party. And it's possibly deeper than that, you know, a probably apocryphal story about Qin Shi Huang, the first emperor of China, the guy who's buried with the terracotta army. After he came to power, he is supposed to have burnt all the books and buried all the scholars. It's actually a Chinese saying, so that he would be in complete control of information. And in some ways, I think that attitude towards information control is a very old phenomenon in China, and it's not just the Communist Party like that. So it's very difficult to see, you know, tomorrow, say, the Great Firewall just being switched off. I do myself believe if it did happen, it would probably do much less harm to the government than they think.
Well, Jeremy, once again, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Jeremy Goldkorn is founder and editor-in-chief of Donwei.org, a website devoted to Chinese media. Last summer, we featured a story about the first Internet Addiction Treatment Center in the United States. At the time, it had only one patient, and we thought it was something of a, well, not joke exactly, but maybe a hysterical reaction to a non-problem. Well, we might not be finding it all that funny in the future, according to the new Frontline episode, which airs on PBS nationwide next week. Digital Nation, an hour-long program about the consequences of our increasingly wired lives, is co-hosted by Douglas Rushkoff, who kindly offered to recut a small portion of the TV program for our radio show.
Back in the day, the early 1990s, or three centuries ago in internet years, those of us looking toward America's digital future always turned to Asia for a glimpse of what might soon happen here. Asia, and South Korea in particular, seemed to be leaving us in the dust as far as technology usage, with their government literally rebuilding their society around devices that weren't even on the market here. At least not yet. But now that texting is a road hazard, Facebook is our kids' social life, and gaming is perhaps the only thriving entertainment business, many of us are wondering just how digital our lives might yet become, and what the heck we're supposed to do about it. So I went to Korea to see what answers they might have for us about our own future confronting the digital revolution. It's not altogether pretty. South Korea has become one of the first countries to confront the fallout of the digital revolution. Many say the national gaming obsession is getting out of hand and taking a toll on the nation's youth.
It's pretty extreme. I play 7 or 8 hours a day. Then on weekends, I stay up all night on the computer.
Over the last year, 15-year-old Chung Yong-il has dropped from the top of his class to the bottom. His mother blames the computer.
When Yong-il starts a game, he doesn't know when to stop, and he just plays for hours. I think if I can't control him right now, I may lose my son. This is an addiction. Only an addict could act this way.
There's an argument about whether it's a real disease or just a phenomenon. but we think it's definitely an addiction.
Dr. An Dong-hyun conducted a 3-year study on the question of internet addiction. His findings helped Korea become one of the first countries to treat it as a psychiatric disorder.
About 90% of Korean children use the internet in their daily life. Of those, about 10 to 15% are in the high-risk group.
Welcome to the Internet Rescue School. This is a 2-week treatment camp.
In an effort to help kids like Young-il, the Korean government has funded internet rescue camps throughout the country.
The reason you're all here is because you want to decrease the time you spend on the internet.
At the recommendation of a teacher, Young-il's mother will be leaving him here for 2 weeks. The day starts with a group counseling session.
Because of the internet, my health has gotten worse and there's no structure to my life. Who's checked that box? Everyone has checked that box?
Most of the kids here say they've had to seek medical treatment for conditions that resulted from overusing the computer, like eye strain and ear complications. Here, they spend lots of time outdoors, engaging in physical activity. It looks a lot like summer camp. The surprisingly low-tech treatment regimen seems designed mainly to recapture a childhood lost to the computer. But it's a struggle for kids like Young-il.
When you go home, will you start using computer again? Or will it be different?
Honestly, I don't expect a lot. Not using the computer for 10 days was hard. I just kept thinking about the games or about getting out of the camp and going home.
To prevent cases like Young-il's from happening in the first place, the Korean government is taking aggressive steps to instill healthy computer habits early. At Korean elementary schools, kids are taught to go online at around the same time they are taught to read.
How should we use the internet in the future? Write about 3 lines. How many? 3.
But they're also taught how to use computers responsibly. It's required for Korean students, starting in the 2nd grade.
One more time. Click!
At this school, signs preaching healthy internet habits line the hallways.
And what's this one say?
Slanderous comments on internet hurt my friends.
Another reads, constantly playing computer games shrinks your capacity to think. First grade instructor Yoo Soo-kyung says learning internet etiquette is more important for kids than understanding how the web works.
When a child is just 6 years old, what's the most important things they need to learn about the internet?
I think they must learn ethics first, internet etiquette and manners, and then learn the technical side of it.
To drive the point home, children learn this netiquette song, preaching good manners and accountability online. The chorus? I am the guardian angel. I will be the first to protect. Though faces are unknown, it's a warm neighborhood, precious internet friend, netiquette. I don't know. This top-down, one-size-fits-all approach to net hygiene might not be embraced as readily in a country like America, where we can't even agree on how to fund our regular health care. But the fact that they're on the case, and that their embrace of the digital has led to a recognized public health crisis, might serve as a wake-up call to those of us who assume that our own digital natives can really take care of themselves out there. For On the Media, I'm Douglas Rushkoff.
Douglas Rushkoff is the correspondent for Frontline's Digital Nation, which appears on PBS stations Tuesday night. This Wednesday, while the political press waited eagerly for the president's State of the Union address, the technology press waited for another leader to make a very different kind of appearance. This address was Apple CEO Steve Jobs unveiling Apple's new iPad tablet computer. 5 OTM producers were glued to their computer screens to watch live blogging of the event. Kind of sad. While most wished to remain anonymous, one OTM producer, Mark Phillips, agreed to share his thoughts on why everyone cares so much.
Cable news cut away from what they were doing to show pictures of Steve Jobs holding up the device.
Breaking news now coming out of San Francisco, and yes, they have now unveiled. Apple has unveiled its new tablet, and you want the name? iPad.
Twitter was abuzz with jokes about the unfortunate name, and bloggers griped about missing features. And then came the reports from tech journalists at the Apple event who got to play with the device. This whole time, I'm sure many of you were thinking, who cares? It's true. The iPad could prove to be a total dud. But we're not crazy for caring about it anyway. About a decade ago, Steve Jobs hosted a similar presentation. He was even wearing the same trademark black shirt and jeans.
We are introducing a product today, and that product is called iPod.
The audience did not gasp, and sales were lukewarm for a few years. But today, there's no way to argue that the iPod was anything less than revolutionary. Many of you are listening to one right now, and even if you've never touched an iPod in your life, it's changed the way music is sold, shared, and listened to, for better or worse. Of course, there was no way to know that all the way back then, because the first iPod was just okay.
We're not going to be using this iPad next year.
Farhad Manju writes about technology for Slate magazine, and he says that even if this iPad is just okay, the next one could be sweet.
There'll be a better version that has more capabilities, and there'll probably also be competing versions of it from other companies. I hope that this is sort of a new category of computers that lots of people try to build.
This new category would fulfill the prophecies of technologists. For years, they've been forecasting the arrival of the so-called fifth screen. First, there was the film screen, then the TV screen. Third came the personal computer screen, and fourth, the cell phone screen. The fifth screen, the believers say, would be the final one that works with all the others to create technological enlightenment. It could be your window to the internet, but also a panel to adjust your home's energy consumption. Doctors could use it to view patient charts, and architects could use it to tweak 3D models on site. Devices like them have existed in movies and TV shows for decades, and so this is the moment where we find out whether sci-fi becomes reality or whether it's just another flying car. Slate's Farhad Manju got to play with Apple's iPad on Wednesday, and he says it's the real deal.
Until you use it, it seems a little odd, but once you use it, it seems like a very... You wonder why they didn't invent it before. It just feels very natural.
But the fifth screen's allure is that it will be the last screen. You wouldn't need another one for this or that because the fifth screen would interact seamlessly with everything. But Apple's recent history suggests the iPad will only work with the things that Apple allows. And it wasn't always that way. Jonathan Zittrain, co-founder of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society, told us last year that one of Apple's first products, the Apple II desktop computer, succeeded precisely because anyone could write whatever program they wanted for it.
Back in 1979, Dan Bricklin and Bob Frankston, two guys unknown to Apple, invented VisiCalc, the first digital spreadsheet ever. And businesses around the world were ecstatic, and Apple IIs were flying off the shelves, and Apple had no idea why. They had to do market research to figure out what had made their box so popular because of what these outsiders had done. If you are the Bob Frankston and Dan Bricklin of today, you have to get yourself certified as iPhone programmers by Apple, and once certified, you submit your code to Apple, where they will approve it or not.
Apps on the iPad will work the same way, and Apple's history of app rejection is troubling. Jonathan Zittrain.
One fellow wrote a book and then bundled it inside a little application so you could actually run the application that would be his book that you could then read on your iPhone. His book included the F word within it, and Apple refused to allow the application in the store. And after he relented and got rid of that word, Apple said, okay, the application can now run.
Apple's announcement this week also included the iBook store, where you can get digital books to read on your iPad. Apple, of course, will have the final say on what books are sold. And it won't just be books that get filtered through Apple's gates. TV and movies will work best on the iPad if they're purchased through iTunes. Newspapers can make apps for the iPad, but they'll have to sell them through the App Store and give Apple a cut. Adobe's Flash software won't work on the iPad, so many websites just won't load. I have no doubt that the iPad is fast and intuitive to use, but that's just half the battle. If this is going to be our final screen, it must seamlessly connect with everything. Your car, your TV, your Apple computer at home, and your Windows PC at work. For now, Apple seems uninterested in that kind of connectiveness. And so long as they are, don't count on this being your last screen. For On the Media, I'm Mark Phillips.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Buolo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, and PJ Vogt, with more help from James Hauver and Alex Goldman, and edited this week by our senior producer, Katya Rogers. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. Thank you, Zach, for all your hard work over the last 2 years. We will miss you. Radio's loss is totally social work's gain. John Keefe is our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can also post comments there or email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. Brooke Gladstone will be back in a couple of weeks. That is official. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.